Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. What you just heard was not the announcement that the McGuinty government's welfare review will begin in January and last for 18 months, nor that the panel won't report back until after the next provincial election on October the 6th. What you heard were tuition fee protests in Britain, as tuitions there have risen and students have turned violent for the second time in 2 weeks. Around 10,000 students took part in marches and gatherings across the country to protest against the coalition plan to raise tuition fees to £9,000. Demonstrators smashed the windows of a police van in Whitehall and scrawled slogans across its doors, and a number of bottles, sticks, and eggs were thrown at a cordon of officers. The Metropolitan Police confirmed that 3 protesters have been arrested in London for violent disorder and theft, while a further 2 arrests were made during scuffles with the police in Cambridge. One policeman's arm was broken in a confrontation, while another was knocked unconscious. London Ambulance Service confirmed that 8 people had been injured during the demonstrations in the capital. The demonstration followed a day of action 2 weeks ago that saw 60 arrested and dozens injured when a riot broke out at the Conservative Party headquarters. Police are keen to avoid a repeat of the chaos that ensued on November 10th when they were caught out by the splintering of the march organized by the National Union of Students and the University and College Union that preceded the riot. Scotland Yard and the National Public Order Intelligence Unit have been monitoring information to anticipate the latest protests. Marches have been organized across England and Wales, with school and college students joining the action. Police clashed with demonstrators in Warwick and Sheffield, while protests were also held in dozens of other cities, including Birmingham and Newcastle. In Trafalgar Square, central London, several thousand gathered on the steps outside the National Gallery and at the base of Nelson's Column for a rally watched closely by police officers. They chanted slogans including "Tory scum" and "No ifs, no buts, no education cuts," and carried placards reading "Rest in peace, my degree," "Nick Clegg, shame on you," and "David Thatcher's education snatcher." Students claimed there would be no repeat of the violence that marred the earlier protest. Griffin Dill Young, 20, from Camden, North London, said, "I hope the message gets across this time. Everyone's quite hyped, but I don't think it will turn violent. I wanted to be here because if someone can't afford to go to university, it's a complete waste of their talent, and that's not a good thing." Ralph Pritchard, 15, from Emmanuel School in Clapham, southwest London, said he was chased by his headmaster as he left the premises today to stop him attending. He said, I'm here because the coalition are cutting too early and too deep, especially in education. I'm not 100% against violence because direct action can work, but I don't want to get arrested. Emily Bax and Francesca Gordon, both 16 and in year 12, were among 200 teenagers who came from Camden School for Girls to protest. Emily said, how can you cut education when there's so much unemployment? And that story from Andy Bloxham, published on the web on 24th of November. We've lost the reference to the newspaper that originally published the article. HIV infections and AIDS deaths fall worldwide. The global AIDS epidemic is gradually being turned around, with new infections and deaths falling. But UNAIDS warned in its annual report that at a time of financial cutbacks, future progress is far from certain. We've halted and begun to reverse the epidemic. Fewer people are becoming infected with HIV and fewer people are dying from AIDS, Michel Sidibe, executive director of UNAIDS, says in his foreword to the report. But he says it is not yet time to say mission accomplished. Growth in investment for the AIDS response has flattened for the first time in 2009. Stigma, discrimination, and bad laws continue to place roadblocks for people living with HIV and people on the margins. HIV incidence has fallen by more than a quarter between 2001 and 2009, a third of them in sub-Saharan Africa. Some of that is a result of prevention efforts, which appear to be changing unsafe sexual behavior in some countries, while some is a result of the natural course of HIV epidemics, the report says. South Africa, with an estimated 5.6 million people living with HIV last year, has the largest epidemic in the world. That in the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, November 24th, by Sarah Bosley in London. And an epidemic in slow motion. Warning, holding a cell phone against your ear may be hazardous to your health. So may stuffing it in a pocket against your body. If health issues arise from ordinary use of this hardware, it would affect not just many customers, but also a huge industry. Voice calls in the U.S., 2.26 trillion minutes annually, according to the industry's wireless association, generate $109 billion for the wireless carriers. Devra Davis, an epidemiologist who has worked for the University of Pittsburgh and has published a book about cell phone radiation called Disconnect, surveys the scientific investigations and concludes that the questions of the effects of low-energy radiation are not yet settled. Children are more vulnerable to radiation than adults, Davis and other scientists point out. Radiation that penetrates only 2 inches into the brain of an adult will reach much deeper into the brains of children because their skulls are thinner and their brains contain more absorptive fluid. No field studies have been completed to date on cell phone radiation in children, she says. The Wireless Association, however, maintains that all FCC-approved wireless phones are perfectly safe. The largest study of cell phone use in brain cancer has been the Interphone International Case Control Study. The authors included some disturbing data in an appendix available only online. These showed that subjects who used a cell phone 10 or more years doubled the risk of developing brain gliomas, a type of tumor. Davis recommends keeping a phone out of proximity to the head or body by using wired headsets or the phone's speaker. Children should text rather than call, she says, and pregnant women should keep phones away from their abdomen. The FCC concurs about the best way to avoid exposure. It is not by choosing a phone with marginally lower radiation, it says, but rather by holding the cell phone away from the head or body. Davis, citing unsettling findings from research in Israel, France, Sweden, and Finland, says, I do think I'm looking at an epidemic in slow motion. And that by Randall Strauss from the New York Times News Service in The Spectator. Yoga within limits. Fibromyalgia is an extremely debilitating disorder. Patients experience widespread pain, fatigue, and sleep disturbances. They can suffer from the condition for years, even decades. But a small pilot study found that patients who added yoga to their regular treatment program, which usually consists of various medications, physical exercise, and coping skills, reported a significant improvement in their symptoms. Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland recruited 53 women diagnosed with fibromyalgia. Half of them took part in a yoga program that included gentle poses, meditation, breathing exercises, and group discussions. The other volunteers continued with their existing therapies. When the two groups were compared after several months, those given the yoga training were much better off, according to the results published in the journal Pain. Lead researcher James Cason cautioned that the treatment used in the study started gently and gave patients time to gradually adjust. Yoga in North America and Europe has now been largely reduced to a set of stretching exercises where people are trying to do extraordinary things with their bodies. That is certainly not going to be a good fit for people with chronic pain. The training program also put a great deal of emphasis on meditation, a component sometimes missing from yoga courses offered in the general community. Overall, the treatment helped patients adopt what Dr. Cason terms a healthy acceptance of their condition and develop better coping skills. It's not an acceptance that means a resignation and giving up, but an acceptance in the sense that you directly face your difficulties. That article from the Globe and Mail, the Life section, no date, no attribution. Heart drug produces spectacular results combating cholesterol. We are the most excited we have been in decades about a novel drug, said Dr. Christopher Cannon of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. The Merck drug, and you'll have to trust me on the pronunciation, and anacetrabib, won't be on the market anytime soon. It needs more testing to see if its dramatic effects on cholesterol will translate into fewer heart attacks, strokes, and deaths. Merck and Company announced a 30,000-patient study to answer that question, and it will take several years. An American Heart Association conference in Chicago presented results November 17th. The data looks spectacular, beyond what anybody would have expected, said Dr. Robert Eckel, a University of Colorado cardiologist and past president of the Heart Association. Researchers found no safety issues during the 18-month study, and patients receiving the drug had fewer serious heart problems than those given a placebo. More than 1,600 patients participated in the Merck-sponsored study. Many statin users still suffer heart attacks, so doctors have been trying to get LDL, bad cholesterol, to very low levels, and to boost HDL, good cholesterol. It appears to have had a huge effect on raising HDL, the good cholesterol, Dr. David Spence, a University of Western Ontario neurologist, told the Stars, Joseph Hall. The drug also appears to lower a clotting factor known as LP-A, which is a risk factor for vascular disease, Spence said. This is the beginning of an interesting story that looks very exciting. And that from the Associated Press via the Toronto Star. Stunning formula find in childhood diabetes study. The majority of children who develop type 1 diabetes can avoid or significantly delay the ailment simply by switching formulas in infancy, a new Hospital for Sick Children study suggests. A decade-long study showed more children at genetic risk for developing the insulin-dependent form of the disease do not develop it if they were fed a formula created for infants with cow's milk allergies. They are stunning, Dr. Michael Dosh, a senior sick kids scientist, said of the results. About 80% of children who develop diabetes carry genetic risks for the disease. Dosh, a study co-author, says in Canada, the vast majority of kids with so-called childhood diabetes have acquired it by age 10. The pilot study results show more than half the kids who were fed the alternative formula have avoided the disease at age 10. The study was released in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's believed allergic reactions to cow's milk during the first 6 months of life set off the autoimmune response that attacks insulin-producing islet cells in the pancreas, Dosh says. The destruction of those cells causes the disease. Exclusively breastfed at-risk babies are likely protected as well. And that by Joseph Hall, health reporter in the Toronto Star. Parents battle to keep diabetic kids safe in school. Several children with type 1 diabetes and their parents met with MPPs from all three parties at Queen's Park. They want the province to pass a private members bill that would ensure schools support diabetic children. Bill 5, introduced by Brant MPP Dave Leback, is a charter of rights for diabetic students. It would ensure things like a safe place to take insulin and enough time to eat meals. Says Mandy Conlon, co-founder of Diabetes in Ontario Schools, basic necessities for diabetics are often not met by schools. In the 4 years since her daughter Ashley, 16, was diagnosed, she's often been asked to leave class when she needs a juice box to keep her blood sugar regulated. There are approximately 7,000 school-aged children with type 1 diabetes in Ontario. And that by Kate Allen, staff reporter in the Toronto Star. Robert Latimer granted full parole. Saskatchewan farmer served 10 years for killing severely disabled daughter. 10 years after earning a life sentence for killing his severely disabled 12-year-old daughter, Robert Latimer has been granted full parole. In a written decision that has not yet been made public, the National Parole Board agreed to grant full parole, said his lawyer, Jason Grattle. The decision took effect on December 5th. What this means is Robert Latimer will begin to enjoy a larger measure of personal freedom, Mr. Grattle said. On October 24th, 1993, Mr. Latimer wrapped his daughter Tracy in a blanket, put her in the cab of his pickup truck, and filled it with exhaust fumes. His actions ignited a national debate about mercy killing and the rights of the disabled. Tracy was born a quadriplegic with brain damage. The Saskatchewan Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada imposed a mandatory minimum sentence, a life sentence with no parole, for 10 years. That in the Globe and Mail by Justine Hunter in Victoria. British Columbia, also in Victoria. Homeless can camp in parks, but not in daylight. A court ruling that said homeless people have a constitutional right to camp in city parks doesn't extend into daylight hours, a judge ruled. Last year, the BC Court of Appeal ruled it was unconstitutional for the City of Victoria to prevent homeless people from setting up tents and temporary shelters in parks when homeless shelters were full. The case prompted the city to allow overnight camping between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. Within days of the change, two men were charged with violating the bylaw and argued they had the right to keep their shelters set up around the clock. But Judge Keith Bracken said there are more services available during the day. And that from the Toronto Star, no attribution. Low-income seniors to lose payments if they withdraw from savings. Officer charged in fatal shooting. Manslaughter alleged after SIU probes death of Nigerian-born man. For the third time in its 20-year history, the Special Investigations Unit has charged a Toronto police officer with manslaughter. Constable David Kavanaugh of the Emergency Task Force is charged in the death of Eric Osawi, 26, who was fatally shot after police arrived with a search warrant in a heavily armed tactical unit at an Etobicoke apartment September 29th. The SIU said there was an interaction between Osawi and police. Osawi, a Nigerian-born father of two, was shot, and his younger brother, Ebony, 23, arrested on weapons charges when officers with the Guns and Gangs Unit and Emergency Task Force officers entered at about 1:30 a.m. on Dunbluer Road near Kipling Avenue and Bluer Street West. Daniel Michael, Ebony Osawi's lawyer, said Wednesday his client is out on bail. No trial date has been set. That story in the Toronto Star. Henry Stanchu, staff reporter, Thursday, December 2nd. Another PR nightmare for the Ottawa Police Force. 2009 video shows man being kicked repeatedly by same officer seen in previous disturbing images. Just days after dramatic images of a woman in custody ignited criticism from a judge and troubled the premier, a video from 2009 shows a homeless man, Terry DeLay, being kicked by an officer as he's dragged into a police cell. Chief Vern White says the video may cause further public concerns about how Ottawa police officers deal with people in custody. The delay video comes on heels of video released last week of 27-year-old Stacey Bonds being kneed and having her clothes cut off in an Ottawa police station in 2008. Charges against Bonds were stayed earlier this year. The reports also say both Delay and Bonds were hit by the same officer, a special constable. The Delay video has been considered by the judge in the Stacey Bonds matter and as such is part of the ongoing Ontario Special Investigations Unit investigation, White said in a release. Ottawa police have also been served notice that another woman, Roxanne Carr, is alleging abuse while in custody in 2008. Video of Bond's 2008 strip search was released after Justice Richard Lajoie's decision last month to stay charges of public intoxication and assault. Lajoie criticized the conduct of police, saying he was appalled that Bonds was strip searched in the presence of male officers. Bonds was left topless in a cell at the police station for 3 hours in soiled pants after her top and bra were cut off. That from the Canadian Press, Thursday, December 2nd, via the Toronto Star. Affordable housing strategy to ease strict rent rules. Scores of complicated rules governing rents and subsidized housing will be eliminated or simplified as part of Ontario's long-awaited affordable housing strategy, the Star has learned. Housing Minister Rick Bartolucci unveiled the strategy in Hamilton last Monday. Later in the afternoon, a new housing act was to be tabled in the legislature, sources said. Under the proposed strategy, rent-geared income would be calculated just once a year, based on annual income rather than adjusted monthly whenever a tenant's income changes. There will also be provisions to allow rent to be lowered for tenants whose income drops substantially between annual calculations. But tenants whose incomes rise would no longer see their extra cash immediately gobbled up in rent hikes. That change will be particularly helpful to subsidized housing tenants trying to escape welfare or supplement their meager disability benefits with part-time jobs, sources said. However, the strategy makes no commitment to build new affordable housing at a time when almost 142,000 households are waiting up to 20 years for subsidized apartments. Nor does it introduce a housing benefit to help low-income households cope with unaffordable rents when the average rent in Toronto for a two-bedroom apartment is $1,134. A single person on welfare with one child receives only $1,014 a month. However, sources say the strategy commits the government to study the concept of a housing benefit, a move many advocates will embrace as a positive sign. Under the proposed new Housing Act, municipal authorities would be directed to develop local affordable housing strategies to reflect local needs. In exchange, they would get more administrative flexibility to carry out those strategies, sources said. Advocates say they want to see changes to legislation to encourage diverse mixed-income communities, a commitment to build new affordable housing annually, and a housing benefit to help low-income households cope with unaffordable rents. That by Laurie Mossa-Bratton, social justice reporter in The Star. Too many Canadians on the brink of being homeless, Dr. Huang. For every person sleeping in a shelter bed, there are 23 households on the verge of homelessness, according to a dire report released last Friday. These vulnerably housed Canadians are spending more than 50% of their monthly income on rent in crowded and unsafe housing, and many face the same myriad health problems as those with no home at all, states the report that calls for a national strategy to address the housing crisis. Dr. Stephen Huang, the Toronto doctor who authored the report, called the country's lack of a national housing strategy deplorable. Housing is just as essential to the health of Canadians as nutritious food, clean air, fresh water, and access to medical care, said Huang, a physician with the Center for Research on Inner City Health at St. Michael's Hospital. If we ensure that people have their basic housing needs met, we would actually be making an investment in the health of our population. Earlier, a parliamentary committee released a report on poverty that also recommended a long-term national strategy on homelessness and housing. The report, tabled in the House of Commons by the Committee on Human Resources, Skills and Social Development, argued that federal policies can make a significant impact on poverty, citing the 1998 National Child Benefit as an example. Wang will present his report in Ottawa at a research forum on homelessness. It was based on data from a landmark study tracking the health of 1,200 homeless and marginally housed people living in Toronto, Ottawa, and Vancouver over 2 years. Initial findings show both groups have similar rates of chronic health conditions like hepatitis C, and nearly 40% had been assaulted in the last year. About half have been diagnosed with a mental health problem. Another 40% cannot get the health care they need, and 55% had visited an emergency room in the last year. Huang said researchers and policymakers have made a false distinction between the homeless and the marginally housed. We've kind of thought of it as if you're not homeless, you're housed. And that means things are okay, he said. But one of the points of this report is that there are people who are vulnerably housed, who are at as much risk as those who are homeless. Huang also led a study in 2009 that suggested homeless and marginally housed people die 7 to 10 years earlier than those with suitable housing. Men in that study had the same chance, 32%, of living to 75 as an average man in 1921, before the advent of antibiotics. And that story from the Toronto Star by Boris Spremo with Nikki Thomas, staff reporter, published on Friday, November the 19th, 2010. Increase welfare to decrease hunger, inquiry hears. One of the keys to combating the growing rate of hunger is to increase social assistance, panelists at a hunger inquiry heard. Hunger is a serious problem and all indications are it's getting worse, University of Toronto public health professor Valerie Tarasic told the inquiry, which was hosted by the Recession Relief Coalition. It can't be fixed without addressing the income problem, said Tarasic. The ripple effect is gigantic, and I don't think we've begun to calculate those costs. The six-member panel, which included an economist, family doctor, and food activist, heard from more than 30 frontline workers, social service agency staff, academics, community leaders, and people directly affected by hunger. There is a strong link between housing costs and hunger, said Richard Mettern of the Daily Bread Food Bank. His group has seen a 16% jump in food bank visits in the past year, the largest increase since social assistance rates were cut in 1995. Most clients spend nearly three-quarters of their income on rent, said Mattern, who suggested government could build more subsidized housing. Unlike some other provinces, hunger is on the rise in Ontario, in part because social assistance rates have not been indexed to inflation, Tarasic said. The province did increase the maximum monthly Ontario works rates by 1% starting December in 2010. That story, published on Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010, by Isabel Teotonio, staff reporter. No record of whom, but probably the Toronto Star. Now let's take a short break with Pete Liggins, Cadillac Boogie.
I had to have a boogie with the woogie wouldn't wait. Brought me in long black cap like eight. It's all reeked, solid streamlined. I'll joy jumping Cadillacs on time. It's the Cadillac boogie, boogie woogie rolling along. Ugh, 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 I. Ugh, 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 I. Look out, geet, don't be late. This roving cat's got a Cadillac eight. Air foam cushions and a modern design. V8 motor body Fleetwood line. He's rolling, Jack, making time. That cat's purring, got eight kittens crying. It's the Cadillac boogie. Yeah, it's the Cadillac boogie. It's the Cadillac boogie. Boogie woogie rolling along. Around town and want to make a date. Get you a long black Cadillac eight. Get to cruising, boy. Fall on the scene. Gals will start jumping, your money'll be green. It's the Cadillac boogie, boogie woogie rolling along. now that you have dug this cat-like gate, help cat daddy don't miss no dates. Traveling man, curving ground, picking up all the fine chicks in town. It's the Cadillac boogie, boogie woogie rolling along. Roll the boogie!
I direct the reading of this article particularly to women's advocate Armin Yalnizian. Recession exacerbates poverty among young men. Ottawa. The recession has left a lingering bruise on an increasingly vulnerable sector of Canadian society, young, single men. Social scientists coming to the same conclusion Carrie Kaiser has reached intuitively by watching the clientele at her downtown Ottawa food bank. Single males are screwed, she said bluntly. I don't know why. She has an inkling, though. The young men who show up hungry on her doorstep are spending most of their welfare checks on rent. They don't get the benefits or the subsidies that governments have set up over the years for struggling families. We see them getting it at all angles, Kaiser said. Her observation dovetails with the findings of John Stapleton, a social policy researcher who has just completed an exhaustive study of social assistance during the recession for the Mowat Center for Policy Innovation. Stapleton has sifted through welfare data from five provinces representing 79% of the country's population and found that the recession has revealed two key trends. The good news, he writes in his draft paper, is that federal and provincial programs for families have helped single mothers. They have better access to child support than in the past, as well as new child benefits. Many single parents are able to cobble together several different kinds of assistance to make ends meet. They've also been more adept at finding jobs in the burgeoning service industry, Stapleton says, partly because those service jobs have traditionally gone to women. As a result, the number of single mothers relying on welfare has actually fallen, he found. In Ontario, for example, the caseload has dropped by 75,000 in the last 9 years, a decrease of 21% despite the recession. The opposite is true for young single men. In Ontario, the number in this group on welfare has risen 61% in 9 years to 148,000 from 92,000. Similar increases were found in British Columbia, Quebec, New Brunswick, and Newfoundland and Labrador, Stapleton writes. Single young men are the new face of poverty in Canadian cities, he says. Many of the young men relying on welfare are visible minorities. Typically, their welfare payments are about a third of what they would be paid if they had a steady minimum wage job, putting them far below the poverty line. They don't have access to other benefits, find it difficult to qualify for subsidized housing, and have had a hard time landing new jobs in the services-based economy, Stapleton says. Stapleton's gleanings from social assistance data are not surprising to other analysts watching the effects of the recession. Craig Alexander, chief economist at Toronto Dominion Bank, notes that during this recession, young males really bore an enormous brunt of the job losses. During the worst days of the downturn, for men between the ages of 15 and 24, about 170,000 positions were lost. Young men have only found a net new 20,000 jobs since the beginning of the year. For Stapleton, the solution lies partly in the success governments have had in helping single moms. If provincial, municipal, and federal governments can target young people with a variety of supports, the way they've done with lone parents, then impoverished young men will find it easier to make ends meet, he says. And that story on November 24th, again, the credit for the newspaper collected from the web has been lost. It's probably a wire service story. 25% spike in number of seniors in poverty. Demographic shift undermines Canada's success in tackling issue. The number of seniors living below the low-income cutoff, Statistics Canada's basic measure of poverty, jumped nearly 25% between 2007 and 2008 to 250 from 204,000, according to figures released by Campaign 2000. Economists say women make up as much as 80% of the increase in seniors' poverty. Men over 65 are twice as likely as women over 65 to have a job. By January 2009, there were 23,000 fewer women over 65 working than there were 7 months earlier, while the number for men changed very little, said Armin Yelnizian, economist at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. My guess is that majority of women who are still working over 65 are not carrying on with their career, but trying to have a little more comfort in their lives. They were probably never too far above the poverty line, whatever line you pick, Ms. Yelnizian said. That story in the Globe and Mail by Joe Friesen, demographics reporter. Low-income seniors to lose payments if they withdraw from savings. Rule changes mean one-time major expense, such as funeral, puts federal support at risk. Low-income Canadian seniors could be driven into poverty next summer when they find out Ottawa has cut their federal income support. The federal government, without public notice, changed the rules for the way lump sum withdrawals from registered retirement income funds affect guaranteed income supplement payments. Low-income seniors across the country will be affected if they withdraw more than the minimum allowed from their RIF, or the Registered Retirement Savings Plan becomes in retirement. For example, if a senior with an income of $13,000 withdraws $5,000 from a RIF for a one-off expenditure, whether to pay for an uninsured health treatment or a family member's funeral, the new policy would treat his or her income for that year as $18,000. That would place them above the $15,815.99 threshold for receiving guaranteed income supplement payments. The issue is of particular importance in Newfoundland and Labrador, where failing to qualify for guaranteed income supplement could mean the loss of prescription drug coverage. In a written response, Human Resources Minister Diane Finley defended the change and said the courts had urged Ottawa to clear up the rules in this area. Yet Ms. Finley's office had more to say when informed the Globe would be writing a story on the issue. The minister has instructed the department to urgently review this policy, said Ryan Sparrow, Ms. Finley's director of communications. Guaranteed income supplement payments can range from just 40 cents a month to $658.40 a month, depending on income. These amounts are in addition to old age security payments. In the past, such RIF withdrawals were only counted for income tax purposes. While a special provision allowed seniors to have guaranteed income supplement calculated based on their projected income rather than last year's income, that option was revoked in May without any public notice. That means low-income seniors could find out in July 2011, when the next round of GIS payments are allotted, that their 2010 income was too high for them to qualify. People won't find out until July 1, 2011, that they've just screwed themselves, said Newfoundland Liberal MP Jerry Byrne, who raised the issue in the House of Commons. They're going to be shocked. Pam Hyatt, a 74-year-old actress in Toronto, said the changes seem unduly harsh. If they've got an emergency like a funeral or an operation not covered by provincial insurance, they should be able to pull some money out of their RIFs in order to help themselves or their family. And that story in the Globe and Mail. Credit Bill Curry in Ottawa and Joe Friesen in Toronto. Cancer patients angry over cuts to their hospital rides. The Canadian Cancer Society has reduced the mileage rate it pays volunteers to drive patients to Toronto for treatment. The stipend for volunteer drivers has just been cut to 25 cents a kilometer from 35 cents, a money-saving move that has sparked anger among drivers and patients. Can you imagine trying to run your car on 25 cents a kilometer in this day and age, said Ruth Loverock, who coordinates volunteer drivers for the Cancer Society in the Muskoka North Simcoe District. I'm really afraid I'm going to lose some drivers because of this, she said. Ms. Loverock notes that most of the volunteer drivers are seniors on limited incomes and often cancer survivors themselves. They already give a lot of time, and now they're asking them to pay to run their cars, too. Martin Cabat, CEO of the Cancer Society's Ontario division, said a number of options were considered, including cutting the number of patients eligible for the service, limiting the number of kilometers they can travel, charging patients for the service, and reducing the mileage payment, Mr. Cabat said. I'll be honest with you, this was the best of a number of bad options. The hope, he said, is that the cut will be temporary and the shortfall will be made up with donations or a corporate sponsor. There are about 2,800 volunteer drivers in the program. They serve about 16,000 patients annually, bringing some from as far away as Thunder Bay to Toronto for cancer treatment. To date, about 80 drivers have left the program because of the reduction of the mileage rate, Mr. Kabat said. Despite the blow, he vowed that no patient who needs to travel for cancer care will be left behind. Research done by the Cancer Society shows that about 20% of patients who use the service would otherwise not go for treatment. That was the case with Mr. Leyland. The treatment for head and neck cancer can be debilitating, including extreme fatigue, nausea and vomiting, loss of voice, and difficulty swallowing. There is no way we could travel by bus, his wife said. I'm 76 years old and my husband is 79. The trauma of cancer treatment is bad enough. Adding the stress of driving to that would be too much, she said. Ms. Leyland said she understands money is tight but believes the Cancer Society doesn't have its priorities straight. I simply can't fathom how they came to justify this decision. For a lot of these volunteers, 10 cents really makes a difference. Mr. Kabat said the Society understands that. We're so grateful to our volunteers. The bottom line is, we will fix this. That in the Globe and Mail, Andre Picard, public health reporter. Ottawa ordered to make federal websites accessible to blind people. The federal government is being ordered to make its websites accessible to visually impaired users, and the judge who issued the directive says he'll be watching to make sure Ottawa follows through. Mr. Justice Michael Kellen of the federal court gave the government 15 months to update its websites after a blind Toronto woman says she was unable to apply for a public service job online. Donna Jodin, a special needs business consultant with an MBA, launched a constitutional challenge to force the federal government to grant visually impaired people equal access to the service and information on several of its websites. David Baker, Mrs. Jodin's lawyer, said it's extremely rare for the court to follow a case so closely after making a decision. Historically, courts have declared there is a charter violation based on the assumption that the government will bring itself into compliance, he said. In this case, the court may compel the government to disclose what it has done to make the sites more accessible, likely through internal audits, Mr. Baker added. What's more, Mrs. Jodin can force the matter back into court if Ottawa doesn't cooperate, he said. Said Ms. Jodin, it's a sign that people shouldn't be afraid to stand up for their rights. Government lawyers had argued there was no discrimination because the services are provided in other formats, such as on the phone, in person, or by mail. Ms. Jodin, who has been blind since birth, filed the challenge in 2007 after struggling through several attempts to apply for government positions through the Job Bank website. And that from Canadian Press, Paola Lorigio in Toronto via the Globe and Mail. Moms of taser victims work to ban stun guns. The mothers of two men who died after being tasered by police say they are forming a group that will work to ban electronic stun guns. Zofia Sizowski, the mother of Robert Sikansky, who died at Vancouver International Airport 3 years ago after being tasered by RCMP, is joining Bev Grimolfsson, the mother of Trevor Grimolfsson, who died after Edmonton police hit him with a taser several times in 2008. They are also seeking greater police accountability and justice for victims and their families. Star Wire Services for that story. Public probe into G20 rights abuses needed, MPs told. Ottawa. A parliamentary committee was told that a public inquiry is needed into systematic abuse of citizens' rights by the Toronto Police before and during the G20 summit that took place June 26th to 27th. Mike Leetold, a lawyer with the Law Union of Ontario, said his group's firsthand work with protesters at the summit shows that what happened in Toronto that weekend was not caused by an overreaction by the police. We actually observed a systematic targeting of social justice movements in Canada over the period leading up to the G20 demonstrations and during them and after, he stated in testimony at the Commons Public Safety Committee. It amounted to a systematic repression of critics and those who opposed the policies of this government, said Leetold. He said numerous unanswered questions remain about police conduct at the G20 and said a public inquiry with full powers to subpoena witnesses is required to clear the air. In the week leading up to the G20, he said the law union received dozens of reports of young people being surrounded by armed police while walking down the street in Toronto and forced to undergo searches without reasonable grounds by the officers. Leetold said the police also repeatedly cited fictitious powers to justify questionable searches during the summit. An inquiry should find out who ordered what he described as a blatant pattern of bad faith searches by police and a pattern of proactive targeting of activists that began well in advance of Saturday, June the 26th. He also raised concerns about the use of excessive force and what he said was the breach of rights of those who were detained. It's vital to find out how this happened and who directed police conduct during the G20, Leetold said. It's the citizens of Canada, the people who live in Canada, who are seeing our hard-won rights and freedoms undermined by the conduct of the police that week, who really suffer when these questions remain unanswered, he added. And that story in the Toronto Star, Tuesday, December 2nd, Les Whittington in the Ottawa Bureau. Probe of nobody's G20 arrest reopened. Police watchdog to investigate further amid controversy over video and alleged beating. Now, the Special Investigations Unit has said it will reopen the probe into the alleged beating of a G20 protester at the hands of police, based on both the police chief's assertion that the video was tampered with and the objection of the person with the camera who says the man arrested wasn't fighting back. The SIU cited the video, which shows 27-year-old Adam Nobody taken to the ground and arrested at Queen's Park on June 26, as evidence police probably used excessive force against Mr. Nobody, who suffered a broken nose and a shattered cheek. The SIU, however, couldn't identify any of the police involved because the arresting officer provided a badge number that belonged to a Quebec police officer who wasn't assigned to the summit. Police Chief Bill Blair pointed to a gap in the tape, alleging the video had been doctored, and referred to Mr. Nobody as a violent armed offender in a radio interview. Then John Bridge, a 36-year-old Torontonian who works as a web designer for a bank, identified himself as the video shooter and challenged Chief Blair's contentions. In an affidavit, he said he briefly turned off the camera, fearing he had to run from police. After a few seconds, he flicked it back on and captured the rest of the incident, he said. He explained that he combined the two clips into a single video, which he uploaded later that day, but denied tampering with them. During the time that I was not recording, I continuously viewed the incident and saw the officers take Mr. Nobody to the ground, he wrote. At no time did I see Mr. Nobody assault or attempt to assault any of the officers. Mr. Nobody and Mr. Bridge have been completely transparent. They have nothing to hide, lawyer Julian Faulkner said. The police, on the other hand, refused to identify themselves as having been there. In an earlier interview, police spokesman Mark Pugash rejected any allegation officers protect each other from scrutiny. It's dangerous to make assumptions. If I was one of those officers, I would take great exception to that suggestion. The SIU agreed to take another look at the case, saying it would ask for evidence from Chief Blair and take a statement from Mr. Bridge. It will also review a further incident in which Mr. Nobody alleged two plainclothes officers beat him. That from the Globe and Mail by Adrian Morrill, Wednesday, December 1st. Ex-StatsCan chief to lead welfare reform. Ontario's much-anticipated welfare reforms will be led by the former Statistics Canada chief, who quit in disgust after Ottawa scrapped the long-form census, the Star has learned. The hiring of Dr. Munir Sheik is a shot across the bow at the federal government by the provincial Liberals. Sheik became a symbol of public service defiance when the statistician quit on principle in July after the Conservative government scrapped the long-form census, which provincial governments used to develop social policy in favor of a voluntary survey. Sheik will join Francis Lankin, a former New Democratic Party MPP and ex-head of the United Way of Toronto, in a two-person panel. They are in charge of what is billed as the biggest redraw of the welfare system in more than 20 years. The panel will make targeted recommendations to overhaul Ontario Works and the Ontario Disability Support Program. The panel begins work in January and has 18 months to report back with a detailed plan on how to achieve needed reforms. An area of concern is the special diet program. The Liberals were criticized by anti-poverty activists after they announced earlier this year they would be replacing the welfare-based special diet allowance in favor of a new and, some believe, less costly program. Provincial nurses, anti-poverty activists, and advocates for the disabled have urged the province to back off on reductions. The second annual report of the 25 and 5 Network for Poverty Reduction urges the province to redouble its efforts to eradicate poverty by making it a priority in the 2011 and 12 budget. Mike Creek, an activist for anti-poverty and a spokesperson for the 25 and 5, said the goal of lifting kids out of poverty has been lost due to the recession. While the government has done the right thing in some spots, such as increasing the minimum wage, unless they start to make poverty reduction a priority again, they will not meet their commitment to reduce poverty for 25% of Ontarians in 5 years. That by Tanya Talaga of the Queen's Park Bureau, with files from Laurie Monsebraten in the Toronto Star. $250 special diet payment stays as welfare reviewed. The Ontario government will keep the special diet supplement for those on social assistance, but says it will tighten the rules as to who receives the $250 monthly allowance. There were 383,977 people receiving Ontario Disability Support benefits and another 451,540 living on welfare in Ontario as of October. That makes a total of 835,517 men, women, and children living on social assistance in the province. Approximately 140,000 people received the special diet, according to the ministry. Anti-poverty activists feared the province would do away with the diet program, which gives up to $250 a month to those with conditions such as diabetes or high blood pressure and need extra money to buy healthy food. Progressive Conservative MPP Sylvia Jones, Dufferin Caledon, said the Liberals backtracked on the special diet allowance. The special diet allowance was phased out, and now we've seen there is a backtrack. They've said, no, we will keep it in until the review comes in, Jones said. The welfare review will begin in January and last for 18 months. The panel will report back after the next provincial election on October 6th. New Democratic Party leader Andrea Horvath said, we are seeing an increased use of food banks and continued poverty in Toronto and around the province. The government has failed miserably on that front. You can have all the plans in the world, but until you start acting on them, nothing will change, she said. Tanya Talaga in the Toronto Star, Wednesday, December 1st, with files from Laurie Monsebraten. Liberals to push new hydro discount in blitz. Armed with 40,000 color brochures, MPPs and political aides will blitz Toronto subway stops to tout the 10% discount on hydro bills kicking in January 1st. The Liberals claim their policies are leading to a new clean energy industry and 50,000 good new jobs by expanding wind and solar projects, though the leaflet does not mention hydro prices are expected to soar over the next 5 years. In the House, McGuinty mocked PC leader Tim Hudak. If they have any idea at any point in time of putting forward something that's thoughtful and responsible, we would love to see it, McGuinty said. NDP Andrea Horvath said, given his dismal 7-year record, why would Ontario families have any faith whatsoever that the Premier's latest plan will work? And that by Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief at the Toronto Star. And from the Globe and Mail, letters to the editor. Hydro should be affordable to all. McGuinty challenges rivals on energy plans, November 25th. How can McGuinty expect pensioners on declining incomes to pay for his ever-increasing initiatives? There simply will not be any future pension increases capable of paying these bills and for those profit-geared, government-instituted empires delivering hydro to our homes. Hydro should be non-profit and affordable to all. Not being able to afford hydro during peak demand hours is not a life worth living in Ontario. I will vote for anyone and any party that will cancel demand meter billing. This is more than just punishing users with the hourly regulation of our lives. Demand metering has gone way too far in controlling how the middle and lower classes will be forced to live their lives in their own homes, while the rich burn as much energy as they want, whenever they want it. That by Frank Itzo, a Globe reader from Markham. And in the good news at the bottom of the barrel, we found this item. Social faux pas? Blame it on a cognitive rebound. You find yourself standing between the punch bowl and the shrimp ring, making small talk with someone you don't know well, eager to duck any well-meaning requests to get together for coffee. But before you know it, you pop the question, want to go for lunch? Research suggests that such paradoxical rebound effects are most likely to occur whenever our capacity for cognitive control is reduced, such as when we are stressed, distracted, or overwhelmed by other tasks. Going too long between meals can also be a problem. Glucose in the blood provides fuel that supports neural activity. If blood sugar levels are too low, you may literally lack the energy needed to bite your tongue. In the now classic White Bear study of 1987, those initially asked to try not to think about a white bear initially reported fewer bear-related thoughts than those asked to think about the bear. But this was followed by a remarkable rebound effect, with far more bear-related thoughts popping into the minds of those in the don't think group. Well-meaning friends or relatives may suggest that you simply try not to think about troubles. Unfortunately, this is pretty horrible advice. Recent research has shown that smokers given such instructions, don't let yourself think about smoking, initially reached for fewer cigarettes. Unfortunately, they ended up smoking more cigarettes than those instructed to talk about their smoking-related thoughts. Similar results have been shown with individuals trying to suppress food-related thoughts. So how can a person avoid doing the worst thing possible if avoiding it only makes it more likely to happen? Focus on what you want to think or do, rather than on what you are trying to avoid. The brain has dedicated networks of regions that enhance neural processing of the targets of your attention, while reducing unrelated neural activity. Unwanted thoughts may best be avoided by engaging your brain in other activities, and eating frequent small meals can stabilize blood glucose levels. Another hors d'oeuvre could help you keep your foot out of your mouth. That by Mark Fenske in the Globe and Mail. And that's all the news we have at Disrespect this week. Come back next week. We will have more. To take us out, and let me go home at 12:45 at night. This is George Jenkins and the Shufflin' Boogie. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited. from live telephone and studio interviews.